From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. In this week's view, I discuss the 2017 ACC Expert Consensus Decision Pathway for Optimization of Heart Failure. This is a wonderful document, and the authors of this document have created a decision pathway that I think is extraordinarily clear and provides, I think, very important insights in terms of our management of heart failure. And what we're going to do is talk about 10 pivotal issues in patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So the first area is going to be entitled Initiate and Switch. Obviously, when we treat patients with heart failure due to systolic dysfunction, we're initiating evidence-based therapies with either ACE inhibitors or ARBs, beta blockers, and diuretics. When patients are stable on ACEs and ARBs, it is appropriate to switch to one of the angiotensin receptor neprilysin inhibitors in patients with stable blood pressure, an EGFR greater than 30 ml per min. And of course, in that group, we want to make sure that the patients are off the ACE inhibitor for 36 hours before initiation of therapy. We add aldosterone antagonists or ivabradine or hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate in African Americans if there are no contraindications. So this is the initiate and switch pathway of this consensus document. The second area is titrate. And we want to titrate the diuretic dose over days to weeks to release congestion. And of course, consider increasing the dose of either the ACE inhibitor, the angiotensin receptor blocker, the ARNI, or the aldosterone antagonist every couple of weeks, targeting a maximum tolerated dose, or particularly doses that have been proven to be effective in the trials. The third area has to do with when do we refer to a heart failure specialist? And I love the group. They came up with an acronym called I Need Help. The I stands for a patient on IV inotropes. The N is patients in New York Heart Classification 3 or 4 or persistently elevated natriuretic peptides. The E stands for end organ dysfunction. The second E is for an ejection fraction lower than 35%. The D, patients with defibrillator shocks. The H is recurrent hospitalization. The E is edema despite escalating diuretics. The L, low systolic blood pressure, less than 90 with a high heart rate. And the P, prognostic. This would be patients who have medication intolerance or where there's a need to down-titrate guideline medical therapy because of low blood pressure. So I love this I Need Help acronym. The fourth area is entitled care coordination. This is very important. More than 50% of our heart failure Medicare patients have four or more non-cardiovascular comorbidities, and 25% have more than six. This, of course, leads to all kinds of inefficiencies in care delivery, difficulties in communication, potential drug-drug interaction or drug-disease interaction, and missed opportunities to achieve best outcomes. Team-based care is probably the most effective approach. Team-based care is defined by the delivery of health services to individuals, families, or their communities by at least two healthcare workers who collaborate with patients and families to try to get to achievable goals based on evidence as well as patient and family preference. And often this includes nurses as well as pharmacists and others. The fifth category is adherence. And improving adherence, of course, is something that we all have to work on. And it starts with trying to understand, tease out reasons for non-adherence in a given patient. This could be poor health literacy, perceived lack of effect, depression, social isolation, cognitive or physical impairment, sometimes the medical condition with polypharmacy or side effects or costs, out-of-pocket costs for agents that cost just more than a patient can provide, and sometimes the health system where there are difficulties with communication, silos of care, lack of refills, etc. One of the things I like about this document, it really suggests that we change the language with which we talk to patients, moving from compliance to adherence and now more to activation or engagement or empowerment. This is the notion that the patient needs support, not blame. Blame is very counterproductive. Part of the adherence notion is the notion of capitalizing on opportunities to improve adherence. And this certainly includes pre-discharge initiation of guideline medical therapy, simplifying the medicine regimens anytime we can, great communication, particularly with primary care providers and other specialists, thinking hard about costs and access, recommending tools that might support adherence. This might be pill boxes or reminders or anticipating problems and anticipating refills. Also behavioral supports like motivational interviewing and certainly monitoring patients who appear to be at risk for issues. This includes medicine reconciliation, looking to make sure that patients understand dosage units and changes, looking at drug levels with things like digoxin or INR monitoring, and monitoring NT-proBNP or BNP based on treatment given. And of course, we need specific patient interventions, including education about medicines, disease, and self-monitoring and self-management health tips and mobile health aids that are really emerging today. The next area we want to talk about is called specific patient cohorts. That is, we need to tailor our therapy for certain individuals. Let's start with African-American patients. They have a risk of angioedema with ACE inhibitors and ARNI, which is 0.5% for ACE and 2.4% with ARNI. Clearly, this risk is higher than in non-African-American patients. While relatively high, it still does not preclude the vast majority of patients being considered for these agents. Also, there's very little data on efficacy for ARNI and ivabradine in African Americans. We want to think about hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate in patients with low systolic pressure rather than ARNI because we have good information on trials that this combination is effective. Let's talk about the elderly. The upper range for enrollment in many of the clinical trials with guideline-based therapy has been 75 years. And there's virtually no data for drugs or devices in trials of patients over the age of 80. And we know that there are higher risk of events, adverse events, in these patients, and the optimal dose for these patients is less clear. Risks of therapy include hypotension causing falls, worsening renal function, polypharmacy costs, and comorbidity. So we have to be, I think, more thoughtful about how aggressive to push both the number of agents and their doses as we treat patients over 75 and particularly over the age of 80. Another area we have to think about is frailty. At least 20% of patients who are over the age of 80 are frail. Their response to guideline-based medical therapy is less certain, and its ability to impact their overall survival and quality of life is also less certain. The seventh area I want to talk about is the cost of care. Clearly, this is a big deal. Cost of cardiovascular medications is the second most important item for patients with heart failure after hospital costs, and it accounts for about 15.5% of their total costs. There are a number of strategies that you and I can use for thinking about how to manage costs. First of all, we need to coordinate labs and imaging results among clinicians to make sure that we don't do unnecessary testing. We need to look for generic equivalents of guideline-based therapy. Sometimes splitting tablets without reducing the dose can be effective. And if you have access to a pharmacist in your practice to help navigate this, that can be very helpful. And many practices have a patient assistant program, which looks at pricing in the region to try to find the best possible price. The eighth area I wanted to go over with you today was managing increasing complexity of heart failure. And there are several guiding pathways that this document offers. First, it says, think about the target doses that have been associated with the best outcomes. Assign top priorities to address factors that limit guideline-based therapy, like azotemia, hyperkalemia, hypotension. Certainly, we want to optimize the treatment of the sympathetic nervous system modulation using target doses of beta blockers and lower doses of the renin-angiotensin system blockade when limited by hypotension. we want to optimize beta blocker dose before considering adding ivabradine, for example. I mentioned that the hydralazine isorbide combination is effective in New York Heart Class 3 and 4 patients who are African American, who are on optimal doses of other therapies. Clearly, we think about device therapy or BIV pacing in patients after they've been on optimal doses of medications for a period of 3 to 6 months, and we've demonstrated that the left ventricular performance has not improved dramatically on medical therapy. We want to treat symptomatic congestion with diuretics, irrespective of the other drugs. We want to optimize team-based care. We want to look for side effects, start low and go slow to up-titrate the medications, and obviously focus on both patient symptoms and their functional capacity, as well as improving objective signs of cardiac dysfunction. And then let's go to number 9, which is a discussion about managing comorbidities. Clearly, there's a bidirectional relationship between heart failure comorbidities, whereby the presence of one seems to increase the frequency of the other, and the prognosis is worse and worse with the number of comorbidities. Cardiovascular comorbidities that are associated include coronary disease, atrial fib flutter, mitral regurgitation, aortic valve stenosis, obviously hypertension. Others that are maybe less important at the time would be dyslipidemia and perhaps peripheral vascular disease. Cerebrovascular disease, obviously important. Non-cardiovascular comorbidities that we have to pay attention to include obesity, chronic lung disease, diabetes, chronic renal disease, anemia, iron deficiency, thyroid disorders, and sleep disorder breathing. Thinking hard about all of these is critical as we try to optimize the therapy of systolic heart failure, as well as the comorbidities that may be associated with it. The last area to talk about is the area of palliative and hospice care. And there are a number of important points to consider regarding this notion. Obviously, it's important for us to solicit goals of care, focusing on quality of life throughout the clinical course of heart failure. Meticulous management of heart failure, particularly the diuretic therapy, is a critical component of symptom relief, and that should continue all the way to the end of life. Palliative care consultation can be helpful in ameliorating refractory symptoms like fatigue, dyspnea, pain, and managing complex decision. And certainly, patient decision aids and decision support tools can help patients and their families frame options and think about what their prospects are. Clearly, we need to help patients and family be prepared to think about their current state, clarify their goals and values, and anticipate treatment decisions and advanced care directives. And this type of preparedness planning should be done annually with patients who have a heart failure due to a reduced ejection fraction. And this type of planning is obviously very important at the time of major interventions as well, like LVAD placement or consideration of heart transplant. Attention to a patient's clinical trajectory also is very important in anticipating future decisions. This would include recurrent hospitalizations, intolerance to medications, obviously renal dysfunction. These types of events should trigger a heightened preparation for us talking to patients and families about the unpredictability of the clinical course of heart failure and what their goals are if a patient is encountering more and more difficult times in management. The transition from do everything to comfort only or hospice is often bridged by a period during which the survival is being adjusted by guideline-based therapy. Sometimes the decision to withdraw medications, reduce their doses, etc. Clearly, we need to have these kinds of discussions with patients, particularly who have recurrent admissions or evidence that there is steady end organ dysfunction that is leading to a very significant likelihood of the patient not making it. So I've covered a lot of topics here related to the 2017 ACC Expert Consensus Decision Pathway for Optimization of Heart Failure Treatment. It's a terrific document. It's fairly clearly laid out. And I hope this podcast at least gives you a flavor for it. You can find the document on acc.org as well as these key points to remember. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org. All of this information can be found on the American College of Cardiology's website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.